Welcome to the Just Raise podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sweeney, and today we are diving into the exciting world of DevTools. Our guest today is Graham Neary, founder of Oso. Graham has raised over $10 million from Sequoia Capital to build a solution for one of the hairiest problems developers face. This is a fascinating dive into the open source sector, DevTools and how they work, and leadership. Graham has worked with some of the best and has some incredibly powerful lessons for anyone building a company. Also, because we're diving into DevTools and I'm a little out of my depth here, I'm joined by a co-host, my friend Chris Behrens, who I worked with at Silicon Valley Bank and who is now a VC in his own right.
Thanks. Hey, yeah, so I'm Chris Behrens. I'm a principal at Sin Ventures. We're a $200 million venture fund located here in New York, investing in seed and Series A cybersecurity companies. But yeah, super excited to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for the intro to Oso. I know you guys haven't invested yet out of Sin. This is your first fund, right?
Yes, $200 million fund one. The two partners were previously investing out of a New York-based fund called Clear Sky Security. So we're kind of a fork off of that vehicle.
Cool. We'll have to do some more on cybersecurity on the Just Raise podcast. It's a fascinating space, one that I barely touched at all.
Would love to.
Graham, I'm really excited to talk to you. It feels like now is a really powerful moment in Oso, where you have the core of a product, you have the capital, you have a team, and now you, your team of, I think, 11, is really going and scaling the business. What's it like to be at Oso right now?
It's kind of, yeah, I think it's a wild time. The space that we're going after, which is application authorization, has been more or less untouched. I think that's kind of crazy because developers have been building application authorization since like the beginning of time, but no one has meaningfully taken a run at how to give developers a standardized way to do this in their apps. And I think that's crazy because every time I talk to candidates about this, anytime I talk to customers about this, they all repeat the same thing, which is that this is like the nth time that they've built this. And so much of what we're doing is not just, it's not just like building a product, but defining a mental model for the world on how to describe like the shape of this problem. And then obviously there's sort of like the natural path of like, here's a way that we can solve it. A lot of what the team is doing right now is like laying these really foundational building blocks for how we think the world should talk about this problem, which is hard work, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a pretty pivotal moment to be at the company. I think just to start us off, can you give the audience a background on what is authorization?
Yeah, so a lot of people talk about auth generally. They're really talking about two separate things. There's authentication and authorization. Authentication is all about checking who you are. It's like your login screen or like the front door to your application. But then once you're inside, you need a way to control who's allowed to do what in the app. So this is like, what pages can you see? What data can you access? What buttons can you click? And all of that is controlled by something called authorization. And traditionally, developers have done all this stuff by hand. And Oso is giving them a standardized way to do that so that they don't have to spend so much time building that and can instead focus on building features for their app.
Yeah, so this is a dev tools product, tools for developers. And it's a lot like Twilio or Stripe or even Modern Treasury. If it's Twilio, it's sending text messages to your users. If it's Stripe, it's taking payments. If it's Modern Treasury, it's like payment ops. That's something that you have to build at every company, but no one really focuses on that. So you're really focused on outsourcing this problem of authorization, being an expert at it, and then allowing all the other engineers at all the other companies that would be your customers to never have to build their own authorization engine again.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think the reason that people haven't traditionally been able to come up with a generic solution that they can just outsource for this is that authorization is really deeply entangled with the app. And so it's not obvious how to achieve something that you can make generically available to every developer for every kind of app. And that's the core of what we've been trying to work out over the last 2 years, is how to come up with a generic way of framing the problem and a generic solution. But I think we've come up with something pretty compelling, which is why we're seeing all the traction that we're getting. And you know, I think most developers don't get out of bed to work on permissions and authorization, except for us, of course.
Graham, I'm curious, what type of organizations are using Oso right now? Is it large enterprises like banks or kind of leaner, earlier startups? And then the second part to that question is, who's kind of driving the OSO adoption within these organizations? Is it like actual developers, or is it kind of coming from the top down from the CTO or a CISO or someone else within the organization?
Broadly speaking, I would say our user base is bimodal. You get people who are building a greenfield application. They have like a certain set of features that they want to build that they determine are going to be too much of a pain to build by themselves. And so they go looking for an alternative. They have experience working on these systems before and they decide they don't want to build them themselves. And so they look for something like OSO. Or they build something themselves. Then over a period of usually years, they go band-aid, and they do a huge refactor. And then they implement OSO. And so we have, you know, startups like Fiddler, Series B MLOps company that built its entire RBAC system on OSO. Startups like Sesh, who's one of the first 50 apps in the Zoom marketplace built on OSO. And then we've got companies like Intercom, who migrated its entire authorization system off of something custom built onto OSO earlier this year. Or Wayfair, a $15 billion revenue a year company, migrated a legacy authorization system onto OSO. So it really runs the gamut.
Yeah, and it sounds like this is a really abstract problem. And it gets at kind of my next question, which is, why hasn't this been built yet, given we're pretty deep into the developers building tools on the internet phase? Can you describe why it's such a challenging problem and how you were able to solve it with your team?
I have a few reasons, and I'm not sure I could claim to like give like the perfect answer to this, but over the last 10 or 15 years, companies like AWS and Twilio and Stripe have kind of proven out this model that if there's something that is not core to your business, you should really offload that to someone else if you can, to a third-party service or a library. I think those businesses, in particular, if you look at something like Twilio or Stripe, or even, you know, the sort of core infrastructure services around Amazon, you know, they really started with things that are really quite divorced from like core application code. And so that makes it easy to really like segment them off and offer them as a service. You take something like authorization, which is really like deeply entangled with your application. I mean, I'll give you an example. Application data is really the same as authorization data. So if you were going to go ahead and build something like Google Drive and you want to pull up a screen that shows all the folders you're allowed to see, are you using authorization data to make that decision, or are you using application data to make that decision? The answer is both. And that's why it's a really hard thing to separate out. And so people have struggled with this question about how do I come up with something that's like generic enough to split out from the rest of my application. And this is why when we started working on the problem 2 years ago, we had a lot of people on the one hand saying, yeah, you know, I just spent 12 or 18 months building my authorization system. And on the other hand saying, there's no way you could build anything that would work for me because it's just too closely tied to my app. So I think this is really the fundamental tension in authorization. But it turns out that after speaking with hundreds and hundreds of engineering teams, you can kind of see the patterns repeat themselves over and over again. And there actually are ways to make these things repeatable. And that's more or less what we've done.
That's super interesting. How long does it typically take a company to get set up on OSO?
For most people, they can get something working in a few hours or a day. Two examples of that they really come to mind are the engineer who implemented OSO at Intercom, specifically laid out a week for himself to try to get a POC working for OSO, for the Intercom authorization system. And he had it done in a day. And that's when he realized like, okay, I think this is going to work. And then ditto for that startup Sesh that I told you about. And so I think just getting something working is really all you need to do to sort of see the power of what's there. And then obviously, depending on how complex the system is and how much refactoring you need to do, I think is sort of what will dictate how long the total process is.
Yeah, that idea of outsourcing, offloading is just such a powerful idea. There are so many businesses, like you said, that have built giant, like top five biggest businesses in the world, top 10 types of organizations based on that. And it's amazing to see that as we've gotten through some of the core challenges, we're now just moving into the second order, deeper challenges that you can begin to offload, like authorization, which is, like you said, so closely wrapped up into every feature of an app.
You know, part of what makes this so compelling to companies is like a lot of companies talk about like every company is becoming a software company and digital transformation and like all this other stuff. Earlier, Chris and I were talking about how hard it is to hire engineers. I think every company is experiencing this. We have a massive talent shortage in engineering. And so whatever engineers you have, every engineering leader has to be thinking about What do I want them working on? I talked to multiple companies in the last few weeks. They have entire engineering teams devoted to authorization, full time, all the time.
Wow.
That is like absolute insanity. Now, just imagine if I couldn't save these companies any money, but you could just take all those engineers and put them on anything else. How valuable that would be to them, given what I know and what every other engineering leader knows about how hard it is to hire engineering talent. I think like in today's market, that's a huge part of the value add for Oso and any other company that can help these companies trying to hire developers offload this kind of work.
Yeah, I was talking to Sam Korkos a while back, who's the CEO of Levels, and he was talking about how his team is almost entirely engineering. And when he thinks about where to task people, he literally thinks about like not only what they're going to be working on and how much their time costs, but the opportunity cost of building that instead of this other feature is just huge, like astronomical when you think about where the company could be a year down the line. And it is pretty amazing. It's just as important as like capital management as a CEO. And engineers really are like the raw materials of the industry. That is a pretty killer sales pitch for sure. The other thing I really want to ask you about is open source. So this is an open source company. You've worked at a few open source companies in the past. You helped lead MongoDB for years before starting Oso. And I'd love to hear a little bit about how you've seen the ecosystem develop from the early days at Mongo to where you are today at Oso. And I know you're doing a few things differently compared to kind of what's state of the art in the industry right now.
I think open source has gone through like a number of different developments over the last like 10 or 20 years and is at an interesting turning point where a lot of companies are trying to figure out sort of like what the next act of open source looks like. You look at like Red Hat as being fundamentally the only really commercially successful open source company from call it like the early 2000s. And that model is effectively a support model. And then you had in the late 2000s, you know, early 2010s, you know, a chunk of companies that sprouted up, MongoDB included, build an open source product and then a commercially available on-prem product that had some sort of management component. And that's what MongoDB did originally. And there's, you know, a handful of others, MuleSoft and Elastic and so on and so forth. And so that model made a lot of sense because, you know, you would have developers downloading the open source product. And then they could relatively cleanly add on or migrate to the enterprise product. At the same time as all that's happening, Amazon launches RDS, where they're monetizing MySQL and then later Postgres. And that becomes a huge, huge, huge business for them. Like arguably like the biggest component of AWS for them. And all of a sudden everyone's like, holy crap, if we can, that seems like a pretty good business. We should run open source as a service too. And so there's other companies now trying to replicate that model. MongoDB launched a hosted database product called MongoDB Atlas, and that has proven out to be very successful for them as well. But it sort of breaks, for open source companies, that kind of breaks the model of open source as a funnel in that way. So if you're going to, as a developer, download the open source product and start using it, the workflow is a bit bizarre to go from that to then using a hosted product. And so I think this is why we're now at this like interesting juncture where companies are trying to decide what is the model for them, where I think a lot of people are going towards this model of having an open source product and then a hosted product is the way that they think about monetizing. But the workflow or sort of the funnel model doesn't necessarily work in the same way that I think everyone originally expected maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
Can you break that down for me? So the difference between an open source product and then a hosted product? As I understand it, you launch your open source product, you build a community around that. It's free open tools that companies can build on. And then the core company on top of that, like you were describing, runs their hosted product, their almost consulting service that does more on top of the open source.
I mean, the main difference is downloading a piece of software and then being responsible for operating that software yourself versus being able to go to your browser and hitting www, how many W's did I just get there? You know, www.pieceofsoftware.com and getting just like a thing that's ready to go. So in the first scenario, you might download a piece of open source software and it sort of got the core pieces that you need. Let's say it were a database. You download the database and you can run that database. But as far as like installing that database on a server somewhere and then configuring it and managing it and patching it and monitoring it and backing it up and all that stuff, that's on you. You're going to do that. And if it goes down, you're going to fix it and so on and so forth. By contrast, you could get a hosted database product like Amazon offers this one that's incredibly popular called RDS. And in the case of RDS, you click a couple buttons and then all of a sudden you just have a fully managed database product. It's just there's a URL for you and it's like your database lives there. Boom, you're done.
Gotcha.
And they're handling configuration, management, patching, monitoring, all that stuff. They're doing all that stuff for you and you pay them per month or, you know, per hour in the case of Amazon.
So I'm guessing the conflict that creates for the customer is they already built their own platform, and then to switch to a hosted model, if they've already built it themselves and already hosting it, then doesn't necessarily give them a ton of value to move to a hosted model after that?
Yeah, like más o menos. I mean, if depending on how far you get in the journey with the open source product, if all you're doing is just trying it out, then I don't know, why try it out in an open source? Why not just have a free tier of the cloud product? Like, what's the point in having a free open source local version of the product? You might as well just have a free tier of the cloud product, the hosted product. If they have gotten meaningfully far with running the open source version themselves, then now they got to do this migration to the cloud. That's a pain. No one wants to be migrating data no one wants to do that. That's like a lot of work. So it creates this like bizarre break in the cycle, the adoption path that I think people weren't traditionally planning for.
So how do you think this gets solved and how are you solving it at OSO?
So I don't know how everyone else thinks about it and I don't know how everyone will solve it. I think it means that a lot of companies will not continue with this model fundamentally. I could absolutely see a world in which people basically... in which people have a hosted product, which is their first class citizen, and they offer an open source product, which is mostly just for purposes of transparency that says like, hey, if you decide you ever want to like go on your own, it's there, but it's sort of not given that much attention. It's just kind of like, it's just kind of there, but it's not taken nearly as seriously as the cloud product, the hosted product. I could see that as being like a likely outcome. In the case of OSO, that's not how we think about it. We're in a different situation. So OSO is not a piece of software that you run. It's a library, which means it's a piece of software that you embed in your app. And so we couldn't run it for you on your behalf, even if we wanted to. That's just sort of not the construct of software that it is. And so ultimately our model is rather than trying to run it for you or run something like it for you on your behalf, we are building things that are like extensions of the OSO product. And we will run those as a service. And so the funnel will sort of continue to operate in the way that we would have expected, where you will have the open source product, which will you as a user, you as a developer will download and you will be able to try and it will make sense for you to try and it will make sense for you to continue using it. There will be no reason for you to migrate to something else because that will just sort of work as is and you will continue to use it. But when it comes time for you to do something, that would be the kind of thing that we would offer as a commercial product, you will just opt into using those in addition to what you're already using in the open source product.
Gotcha. So you start with OSO, you use it, you implement it, and then when you want more powerful features, all the other things, that's where you start to pay for a product. Almost like a game that starts free and then other things get added on as you need them, if you want them. Not a perfect analogy, but...
Yeah, that's right.
Gotcha. Yep.
Grim, I have a feeling you guys have some strong opinions about this, but I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about your approach to community management, whether or not this is something for you guys that lives within Slack, like a public Slack, or are there any tools that OSO uses to really engage with the community of users that you guys have?
It is a topic that I've thought about a lot. There's obvious things that we do. You know, we engage with our community via Slack. Truth be told, I think a lot of people who get involved in our Slack really just want answers to specific questions, and we oblige. Every engineer on the team takes a day managing our, like, being on call on Slack and on call on our intercom presence and our GitHub for anyone who files an issue and doing anything customer facing. We also have a way for anyone to set up a one-on-one with an OSO engineer on the website. And if that comes in on their day, they'll take it as well. So I would say the overriding principle that we abide by is just by making ourselves like 1,000% available and meeting users where they are, which is definitely something that I took away from my experience at MongoDB. I mean, early on, you know, Elliot, one of the co-founders of MongoDB, he would respond. He and Dwight, one of the other founders, also talked about just like how important the experience is early on for people and the importance of just response time, which for them was happening in like Google Groups and Stack Overflow and stuff like that. But I think that really makes a big difference because people then know that there's, it's not just this like project happening out in the ether. There's a group of humans behind it who understand how it works. And as I said, for us, a lot of what we're doing is in addition to educating people on how to use the product, we're educating people on the problem space. And so a lot of the feedback that we get from our users is not just like, oh, thanks, this product is great, blah, blah, blah. But like, oh, you are the only people on the internet talking about the meaty problems in authorization. And I think that piece goes a long way.
When you think of the crypto universe, Uniswap, for example, their code was forked by another project, SushiSwap, and they built something not quite identical, but almost identical on top with changes to governance. Does that ever happen in the non-crypto open source universe?
Yeah, it's definitely happened. I mean, it happened while I was at MongoDB. There was a company that forked MongoDB and built a competitive company. The thing is, like, it's, I mean, again, any of these things is possible, but like that company really struggled. You got to imagine, these code bases are not simple. Okay, these are like complicated infrastructure projects. OSO is fundamentally a programming language. At its core, there's like a virtual machine. All of this is built in Rust. We have bindings for six different host languages. And we've been working on this problem for like 2 years, which until us, no one's really managed to model this problem well enough to genericize. If someone wants to come and fork our code base and try to compete with us, be my guest.
At the end of the day, even if they did, they'd have to compete with you, which is probably not a winning proposition given...
The company that did that at MongoDB, that was a really tough road for them. You fork something, you're basically saying we're going to take the state of the world in 2021 and we're going to start building from that. Except everyone knows that the state of the world at that point is not perfect, except the only people that really understand how it's imperfect are the developers that built that code. No one else really knows about that stuff. And so now they're going to be left with all the, you know, the skeletons and like the tombstones that existed there. They're going to be building on top of that. And like, it's going to be band-aid after band-aid for them. It's like, it's a long road.
Yeah. One of the things I want to call out too, because I just find it miraculous, especially a few minutes into this conversation, is that you're not actually a developer. You're certainly technical, but you're not an engineer by trade or weren't before this. How did you end up working at developer tools companies like Mongo and now OSO?
So when I graduated college, I started working at a management consulting firm that specialized in telco and high tech. This is in like 2009, when all the telcos wanted to build AWS-like businesses. And I worked on a bunch of projects with them and more or less like educated myself on what early stage infrastructure as a service looked like. And got really interested in those kinds of businesses. And at a certain point, yeah, I decided that I wanted to leave working in consulting and I wanted to go work at a startup. I wanted to be in New York, set my sights on MongoDB. And at the time, they actually weren't hiring for anyone who wasn't an engineer. So it took me actually 9 months to get a job there. They just told me the first time I interviewed with them, hey, I think you're, you know, a great guy and everything, but not now, maybe later. I just checked in with them once a month, every month, until I finally cornered them at their Mongo NYC conference after I'd spoken to like a bunch of different people. And I was like, you know, one of you has to hire me. And they did.
Wow.
Yeah. So Graham, I mean, you spent over 6 years at MongoDB, and I think close to three of those were as David Cherry as chief of staff. As someone who has been in like the enterprise software space for a number of years, I mean, David Cherry is just now running a $25 billion company, has IPO'd three companies, was a VC at OpenView, on the board of many companies, and you got to spend an enormous amount of time with him and also John McMahon, the sales leader of a lot of the great companies today, Snowflake and of course Mongo and stuff too. So I'm curious, with that in mind, were there like particular things that you brought from your experience at MongoDB, perhaps leadership lessons or anything that helped kind of guide your leadership today at OSO?
Tons. Where to begin? I was actually just exchanging emails with Dave this morning. Oh, I feel like I have like a sort of like a little mini David Acherry over my shoulder all the time. See, a good one would be hope is not a strategy. That's something Dave used to say all the time. And so anytime I find myself saying, well, I hope blah, I sort of have to like shut my mouth and realize like, well, if I hope blah, then there's something that I need to do in order to adjust, in order to be proactive in changing this outcome. Hope is not a strategy. And I think another one that goes well with that is the only thing that gets better with time is fine wine. Yeah, that's a good one. I had a conversation with John McMahon recently because I spent a lot of my time hiring. One of the main things that I took away from my experience working with them, as a leader, your responsibilities are to recruit, to develop, and to execute in that order. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. If you don't have a great team in place, you really have no chance of building a successful company and sort of going to the promised land, so to speak. You could try like heck to do everything on your own. You could be really, really good at executing. But like, if you're just, you know, working with a group of people who you don't consider to be operating at a really high level, your individual output is not what's going to take you to the promised land. So priority number one, you got to recruit a really, really great team. Priority number two, you got to work to develop those people. And in particular, like really tier one people want to be developed. And I can relate to that myself. So recruit and then develop and then execute. So it's now like, if you get a really good team, you've got a shot. Now you get a really good team and you get to spend some time working with them on developing their skills. Now you get an even better shot. Imagine you get a really good team and you spend some time in development and you even get a, you know, a little bit of time to pitch in on execution. Now you're like really talking and have a really strong shot at getting to the promised land. So one, I think that's just like a big sort of framework that I saw guide the way Dave spent his time at MongoDB and guides the way I spend my time at Oso. But two, I spend a lot of my time recruiting now. So we're a team of 10 growing to 30 over the next year, year and a half. We're hiring for primarily technical roles, engineers, engineering managers, engineering leadership, product, developer advocates, like all kinds of different roles. And this is the most important part of my job right now. And I was having a conversation with John McMahon because I feel like oftentimes in a first conversation with someone, it's really hard to get to the heart of what you're really trying to really understand or learn about a person, especially over Zoom and you're back-to-back meetings, you know, everyone's kind of like crammed. And the feedback that he gave me, which I thought was really dead on, is basically, you're probably not listening. And he's sort of started to talk to me about like a point of view that he's been developing that he wrote about in a book recently, that everyone's kind of in this constant state of partial attention where you're sort of bouncing from meeting to meeting, you're checking your phone, you're checking your notes, you're checking your email, blah, 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 and you're not really listening. And so the upshot of that is it makes it really hard for you to engage with the other person and get what you're expecting to get out of the interview. And he was like, so right. Because, you know, I have a certain set of questions that I was expecting to get out of every interview and I'm managing the time and I'm checking what interview I have next and I'm thinking about the thing I just had in the past and blah, blah, blah. And that completely changed the orientation of how I've been approaching meeting with folks over the last several months. Or now I take actually way fewer notes than I used to. I got rid of my agenda and I spend way more of my time just listening as intently as I can to the person on the other side of the Zoom or the table. That's probably some of the best advice I've gotten recently from him.
I think that's pretty spectacular advice. I edited for like 6 months for Patrick O'Shaughnessy on the Invest Like the Best podcast. And if you ask Patrick how he goes into an interview, the first thing he says is like, don't write questions. Come in with topics you want to talk about, but then start the conversation and then just let it flow. And then having done 50 of these podcasts myself, I can say, that's really hard. You know, Patrick can do it, but the idea of coming in totally blind and then unlocking really interesting ideas about the business, that's difficult. But I find when I'm like at my best, it's just you're listening to the person who's talking and then responding, and it's more conversational. It's generally more engaging and you do unlock more. But yeah, actual listening and doing nothing else is hard. One thing that I love to ask about as well is, what's top of mind for you? What metrics do you track and, you know, what are you focused on over the next couple of quarters?
I mean, adoption. Like we track adoption. Sort of like customers using the product is kind of the is like the most important thing that matters. And so we have a handful of different ways that we look at that. Oso is different from a traditional SaaS business in that people don't log in to use the product, and so we have to use proxy metrics. So we know about downloads, even though Oso is downloaded from third-party package managers, we get that download data from them. So there's downloads. Downloads is an imperfect metric. And if someone caches their downloads, it could overcount if they do a lot of testing on it. So you sort of have to take take it with a grain of salt. So that's one metric that we look at. We look at top of funnel metrics like unique visitors to the website and GitHub stars. We look at middle of the funnel website metrics like how many people are joining our Slack. And then we have lower funnel metrics, a number of derivative metrics that measure different ways that people are interacting with our Slack. Not typically the default ones that Slack provides, but we worked with the head of data science at Sequoia, who's an extremely smart guy and gave us some really smart ideas on how to think about this topic as a way to gauge how deeply people are engaging with the product.
It's a super good segue. We haven't touched on this yet, but Graham, Oso has raised $10 million+ from Sequoia and some other great funds. We'd be curious to hear if you're willing to share how that relationship started. And similar to this data project, I would love to hear if there are like other ways that you've interacted with Sequoia Capital outside of kind of typical board meetings or kind of typical VC engagements.
Sequoia was on the board at MongoDB, and I had the opportunity to see the way that they participated, sort of the way that they interacted with the company. And my main observation was, I think a lot of VCs talk about like, you know, being oriented towards the long term, blah, blah, blah. I definitely saw that play out for them, and that really stuck with me. When I left MongoDB, I was actually working on a project with this person that I just mentioned, who's head of data science at Sequoia. And he was like, well, you know, it's a bummer that you're leaving, but if you're going to leave and start a company, you got to talk to this guy, Bill. So who's Bill? Bill Koren ran the better part of Google engineering for about 10 years. Super understated guy, but turns out he's a bit of a legend. And so, you know, we met with Bill, and we weren't necessarily planning to do a round at the time. And then not long after that, interest kind of picked up in what we were working on. And so we decided to partner with Bill and the Sequoia team at the seed round, and then again at Series A. And they've, you know, they've been great partners. In terms of things that we've done with them outside of traditional board meetings and stuff like that, I mean, working with this guy named Hem on the data science team has been good. We've worked with them on some recruiting stuff as well. I mean, as a founder, one of the main things that I found valuable is just talking to peers who are at a similar stage or a bit later stage. And so they've, in particular, throughout COVID, they facilitated a lot of like virtual ways to connect with other founders. And that's something that I've taken a lot of advantage of.
Sequoia has a real value add, which very believable given their Sequoia. That's pretty cool. My last question for everyone on the show is about your vision for the company long term. So where would you like to see Oso in 20 years?
When I first joined MongoDB, one of the things that I did is I went to user conferences, and I would go to like, part of our thing is that we would just go wherever. We would go like small cities, big cities. I would go to, you know, Cleveland, Detroit, Northern Europe, South America, whatever. It didn't matter. And I would always wear my like MongoDB, you know, jackets and backpack and whatever. And people would call out to me like on the street and in the airport. They'd be like, yo, MongoDB. And I was it. All they wanted to do was just acknowledge. And I think this, that always stuck with me, that if you can, if you take this area of friction for developers and you make it go away, really powerful things can happen. And I think they created a lot of loyalty. I'm not saying MongoDB is a perfect company, blah, blah, blah. And you know, I'm aware that not everyone loves it, but they created a ton of loyalty and sort of a certain kind of affinity. Oso is all about putting security in the hands of developers. I think if you ask most developers, what has been your experience trying to build permissions or what has been your experience in a bunch of these other domains around like application security, you wouldn't get that kind of affinity. In 20 years, my vision is that when people like see the Oso bear, that they should have that level of affinity and that there's just a huge group of people behind it who share in that vision and are looking to forward that vision for, you know, all the people who use the products.
Yeah, that's a really powerful vision. And I think you're probably already on your way to getting there. But Graham, thank you so much for coming on the show. And Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Chris.